Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel. And today we welcome Carl Wiederquist, who is the author of Universal Basic Income from MIT Press. Carl, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks. Actually, I pronounce it Wiederquist, but...
Oh, did I get it wrong already, having just asked you?
That's all right. Close
Wiederquist.
Enough.
Yeah. So if you would, start us off by telling folks a little bit about yourself and what you do and what brought you to this project.
Sure. Yeah. My name's Carl. I grew up in Cassopolis, Michigan, in a little rural town between South Bend, Indiana and Kalamazoo. I came to basic income, actually learned about it from a documentary by Milton Friedman. When I was a freshman in high school, turned out it aired on my 15th birthday. And it was coming from a right-wing person, but I saw it as a big challenge to not just to right-wing people, but to the left as well. If we really want to help people, why are we managing them so much? Why are we saying, you got to do this, you can't do that, you got to do this other thing? We manage people that we're trying to help. And often that management of people, it's not good for the people because they understand their position better than regulators. And often a lot of money is just wasted on putting these conditions on, figuring out and then figuring out if people are meeting the conditions. If you really care about people, put a floor under everyone's income so nobody's income can fall below a certain spot and they'll have enough to meet their basic needs. Then make sure if you get a job, if you earn money privately, you're always better off earning more. Sure, we're gonna tax what you make, but you're always gonna have more if you more left over if you earn more. That way, none of us, rich, poor, in the middle, none of us have to worry about someday we might be on the streets. But we've got flexibility to go out there and enter this economy in whatever way works for us and works for people who might want to hire us.
Terrific. So why don't we start with just some basic table setting? You identify at least five key features to what a universal basic income is. I wonder if you might just walk folks through those so that we know what it is that we are talking about here.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, it is in cash. This is a cash income. We're not talking about food stamps. We're not talking about public housing. We're not talking about giving people a can of food. This is those in-kind things are not basic income. It is in the appropriate currency, it's in cash. It is individual, so it is paid to. Husband gets a check, wife gets a check, the children's guardian gets a check, and maybe as the children reach close to adulthood, maybe they start getting their own checks. But obviously a 10-year-old is not going to get his own check. And right into their own bank account. And the reason for this is because sometimes not all households are as mutually beneficial as we would like them to be, and one person controls the finances, and they get undue control over other people in the households. It is so that's two things: individual in cash. It is unconditional, meaning that we don't make you do anything in order to get it. We don't say you don't have to follow any behavioral requirement. You don't have to get a job. You don't have to say you're willing to get a job if one's available. You don't have to go to school. You don't have to, you get it just because you're a human being and we don't want you to lack food, shelter, and clothing. It is also universal. Now, universal and unconditional are a little bit can be a little bit redundant, because if there's conditions on it, not everybody's going to get it. If not everybody gets it, then there's some conditions where you don't get it. Technically, that's redundant. But universal is emphasizing that not only do we not hold you any behavioral characteristic, but it's not singling out people with special problems. A disabled person might have more difficulty meeting their needs than an able person, but both of them have certain minimum needs. Remember, we're going to have some extra for disabled people. That might be a benefit that's non-universal, and we might need that as well. But we're going to have a little minimum amount for everybody. In cash, individual, universal, unconditional,
and periodic.
And periodic. Yeah, it's coming in regular. So right. Periodic, the last one, being that there are other proposals to give a one-time benefit. If you give a big chunk of money at a one-time benefit, that's not basic income. It might be something that's useful for people, like a coming-of-age grant so that people could spend money on education or something, or get themselves set up in business. That is something different than basic income.
Terrific. Talk to us a little bit about how, in your mind, it might work.
Well, in my mind, it works like having a market economy where income doesn't have to start at zero. We live in a really cruel economy unless your parents are wealthy enough to give you money to get a start in life, you get out of school and you got nothing. You got to find whatever job
except
you can
maybe a lot
keep
of
yourself
debt.
Alive, you know, whatever job you can. And that job might be something like my first job out of college with a bachelor's degree from University of Michigan. My first job was night dishwasher at Denny's. And having a job like that which there's good things in doing that work, but it doesn't have to pay as poorly as it does. Making everybody get whatever job they need to keep them alive can actually interfere with them building their careers. Very often we don't build our careers because we're too busy working for a living. And a lot of people that come from disadvantaged situations don't have that. A lot of us are running on fear. A lot of us do not quit jobs where we're being sexually harassed on the job because we need that job. A lot of us do not leave abusive spouses because we need their money. And we need their money to take care of our children, or we need their health insurance or something like that. With some universal insurance, we can all rest assured a little bit more. We can still play the game of the market economy, but it doesn't have to be one that the punishment for doing poorly in the market economy is so severe. It's so severe that people end up sleeping on the streets and begging for food or eating out of other people's dumpsters. The punishment that I envision that if you screw up in the market economy is you get less money than everybody else. It's going to be something for some bare bones place to live, food to eat, clothing to wear. But we're not going to take that away from you. We're not that cruel. We don't need to be that cruel.
And what do you say to those who are concerned about work disincentives and what it will do to the labor market and to businesses' costs of hiring labor?
Oh, that's what this country needs, is work disincentives. We all have too much incentive to work right now. That's why we get so much sexual harassment on the job. That's why wages are so low. There would be no poverty wages if people could say, I've already got enough to keep me just barely out of poverty. You've got to pay me something decent to get me out there, to get me out of there. We have too much work incentive that the middle class hasn't got a significant raise in real terms in 40 or 50 years. Because all the benefits of the economic growth that we've had in that period, and we're talking about a doubling of our GDP since the early 1980s, doubling of GDP, almost all of that has gone to the top 1% or 2%. Why? Because all of us have such a great work incentive. Our work incentive is even if they, oh, this is, this is my, my alarm reminding me that I thought that this meeting was going to start at 2 o'clock my time. So, oh, and I've got another alarm coming up. So we all have too much work incentive. What we need, every time you give greater work incentive to all of us, the 99% of us who work for a living, what you're giving them is you're taking away the incentive on the other side of that equation, is the employer's incentive. Does the employer have an incentive to treat you like a human being, to give you a share of the increase when he makes more money or she makes more money? Does the employer have an incentive to keep your income growing with GDP? If you have fewer and fewer options, if you've got this great work incentive because you're going to be homeless, you don't keep working, then we all get poor wages, worse working conditions. This country needs a lot more work disincentive than it has now, that's for sure.
So talk to us a little bit about what you think it might cost. You walk through sort of two different core scenarios with different amounts. Talk to us a little bit about what you think it would cost and how you respond to people who suggest that we simply could not afford it.
Sure. The most important thing about basic income, the most important thing to understand is that you're giving an income to everybody, whether or not they work. One thing I said about it being universal also means that rich and poor alike are getting this money, not just singling out people with low incomes and giving it to them. We're giving the money to everyone, regardless of whether or not you need it, just like Social Security works right now. So we have something like a basic income for the elderly right now, where you might pay thousands or tens of thousands or millions of dollars a year in taxes, but you still get your Social Security. Basic income is going to work like that. And people say, well, that's terribly expensive, because they think that the price of basic income, they think, is going to be the level of basic income times the population. But you have to take into account that people are paying themselves, is that we're going to give a basic income to everybody, but also we're going to tax some of that money back in order so the basic income won't cause a lot of inflation. Since we're all paying money to ourselves, to find out what it really costs, you've got to calculate how much are we paying to ourselves. Because the rich, first of all, they're paying their own. They're going to be paying hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in taxes, and they're going to be getting their basic income. You subtract one for another, that will give you the net amount that they're paying. But even the rest of us, those at the low end who are getting more in basic income than they're paying in taxes, they probably are going to be paying some taxes. Most people will work part-time or something like that. And so even people who are net recipients are going to be paying a lot of it themselves. So what you've got to look at, which I do in some of my more technical papers, I look at how many do people in the bottom 1% receive, how much do they pay in taxes? You're looking at the 2 to 3 percentile, how many people are they there? You know that all the one. And when you go through that and total it up, what you find is for about every dollar that is actually being redistributed from rich to poor, there are $6 that people are paying themselves. So the price of it is actually 1/6 of what you think it would be, taking the amount that you're paying, multiplying by the population. So what I calculated for the US using 2015 statistics, so that's getting a little bit old now, was that in 2015 dollars, to eliminate poverty with a basic income would cost $539 billion a year, which is less than a defense budget. It's less than a third of what we're paying in entitlement spending already. It's not a huge increase in spending, and it comes to about 2.95% of GDP. That's the cost of eliminating poverty. So you and I never have to fear that we're ever going to be on the streets again. That costs only 2.95% of GDP in an economy that has doubled in size over the last 40 years, and almost all of those benefits have gone to the top 1%. So yeah, there's plenty of money to pay for this. It's not It's not even terribly expensive when you look at it that way.
And you suggested earlier that this would not, there are proposals that some make in which this would replace almost the entirety of the U.S. welfare state. You don't necessarily envision that. You suggested earlier that there might need to be sort of categorical benefits for people who meet certain categories of disability, other kinds of things. What do you think this could replace? Because there could be additional savings, right, if this steps in for some of those categorical programs you talk about in the book.
Yes. Now, this is that question has a lot of different aspects to it. What can it replace? Because some of this, some of that is economically speaking, who needs what? What can and can it replace? But another aspect is strategically, if you're looking at the aspects of power, what should it replace? Because if we replace everything by one program, even if the program works really well, then its opponents only need to cancel that one program, and then you've lost everything. So there's a strategic reason not to. Now, I don't want to deal with that strategic reason right now. I want to deal with what people actually need. Okay, when you have this, you don't need food stamps. This is going to be way larger than food stamps. Also called SNAP benefits, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. There it is. So SNAP benefits are way smaller than basic income. Basic income buys everything SNAP can buy and more. So if you need flexibility, you get that. It can certainly replace those things. It can replace your standard tax deduction. So instead of getting a standard tax deduction, you get basic income. And it could replace the first, say we've got a basic income at the poverty line, and that's about $15,000. That could replace the first $15,000 of all tax deductions you get. So you don't get any tax deductions unless you're itemizing and it adds up to greater than your basic income. And you get that extra amount. That's a very good way to fit it in with the type of tax system that we have in the United States. Now, it could also... then questionable whether it can replace other things. Now, it could replace also the first, let's say it's $15,000. It could replace the first $15,000 of your Social Security. The idea of basic income is not to double the income of everybody who's already on Social Security or SSI, disability benefits. It could replace the first $15,000 of those. And, you know, you're getting this money, you don't need all that. However, you don't necessarily want to replace all of Social Security or all of disability, because there's a reason we give more money to disability than we do have people now. And that is because they have greater needs. You know, so somebody who's in a wheelchair, we might be want to give them extra than just anybody else gets in basic income. A retired person who's paid into Social Security all their life, they're going to want them to get something extra. So it shouldn't replace all of that, but it can replace some of that. It can replace the first part of that. Now, there's other things that become more difficult. You can't replace the public school system with basic income. There are some people who want, but the idea of replacing the public school system, I just think is a poor system. That's really just a way for rich people to make money off our tax dollars in our school system. We have enough giveaways to rich people than giving them our school system so they can make profits off. That's not what the school system's for. Same thing with health insurance. You can't just get rid of Medicare and Medicaid and other supplements that we have for people who need health insurance. That's not going to work. There's some people who think it's going to work, and I don't think that's a good idea. You can't replace the streets. You can't say, you know, government's giving us all free sidewalks and free streets and free stoplights. You can't give everybody a higher basic income and then privately own the streets and have us all pay a toll in order to go down the street in front of our house. You know, that can't be replaced. A lot of things can't be replaced. Now, then there's others that are a bit of a judgment call. I would say, you know, disabled people need more, and disabled people might need in-kind benefits. Maybe a paraplegic doesn't need cash. They need a really good wheelchair. And we should be thinking, not thinking about internalizing the cost. We should be thinking about, hey, you're a paraplegic. We're going to get you a wheelchair. You don't even worry about the cost. We're going to get you a good one. Because maybe my, because maybe I'm going to be the next one who needs a wheelchair. You know, so we'll make sure everybody has a good wheelchair. I think that'd be a better policy than trying to get them to buy their own. But there are others that are a bit of a judgment call. What about unemployment insurance? You could say you don't need unemployment insurance anymore because while you're unemployed, you can live off the basic income. You might, but if somebody gets laid off from their job and they've got a sudden loss of income, maybe you don't want them to go to all the way down to where they're just living off basic income. Some people would say, yes, you do, because otherwise you're really just preserving existing inequalities, even while people are unemployed. And other people would say, no, we should have a special transition for those people who just lost their job. That's a bit of a judgment call. That's something that has to be worked out as we negotiate this policy.
So as we conclude here, Carl, I'm going to ask you a question that may be a little unfair, that is outside the four corners of the book. You walk through what I find. I am sympathetic to this idea anyway. You walk through what I find to be a convincing argument in the book. But you don't pay a lot of attention to the politics of it.
Yeah.
How do we get from where we are right now to a place where this is conceivable, given the political system in which all of that economic inequality that you've talked about turns into political inequality? Right?
Yeah.
How do you think about getting us to a space where this becomes a more accepted part of the conversation of what we can be doing and for whom?
Yeah. Well, that is a tough question. And it's also that I think gets to what's wrong in American politics. Is I started working on basic income because I was born in 1965. I was raised in a well-integrated town that didn't have a lot of racial animosity that I could see as a kid growing up there. I sort of sided with the shift that Martin Luther King was making just in the last year of his life when he started the Poor People's Campaign. He said, with the civil rights legislation, we made a lot of progress on civil rights. Maybe it wasn't as much progress on racial equality as I'd hoped when I was a kid. But he said the problem then that is also very well connected to our racism problem is the treatment of low income people, how we villainize them, how we demonize them. We got to do things better for the basic income. So I'm like, that's it. That's my issue. I want to work on a society that's more humane to its low income people, because I thought that was the biggest problem we had in the U.S. at the time. Now I realize we got a lot of other problems that are just as big. Racism isn't over. U.S. militarism is abroad is a big problem. This growing white nationalist movement is a big problem in the United States. All of these is as big as the problem I started out with. But there's one more that might be the biggest problem we have in the political system in the United States. That is the legalized system of bribery we have that we call campaign financing. The donor class gets what they want. And the donor class can veto legislation that they don't want. If you don't have anyone who's rich behind a policy reform, it will not happen. Whereas you can get policy reforms that hardly anybody who's not rich performs, and it will still go through. The influence of all of those 90% of voters put together compared to the power of the donor class and actually affecting legislation, maybe not about electing candidates, but those candidates are both sides are taking money from rich people. And so the rich people, the stuff that they really care about, that's what gets passed. But also, it's not just that rich people influence our representatives through their campaign contributions, but they also control the dialogue by controlling the media. Those two big problems go hand in hand. And if you look at around the world, the most democratic systems, the ones where people really influence what happens in legislation are also the ones with the most progressive legislation. Those are places like Finland, like Norway, like Iceland, where you get really good social systems that are much more humane to people who aren't wealthy, because the governments are really controlled by the people as a whole. If we had a government that was really controlled by the people as a whole, there's no telling what would become possible. Those are things that we got to challenge. We got to challenge these narratives that we have in the world that say, if a poor person doesn't want to take a job, that means he's bad. It doesn't mean that the employer is bad for offering this crappy wage and these poor working conditions that people don't want to take, even when they have very little else to live on. We need to be able to challenge those things. We need to take control of the rhetoric that's around us, and we need to take control of our campaign system with reforms along those lines.
You are listening to the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and we have been speaking about universal basic income. That's both the subject and the title of the book, new out from the MIT Press. Carl, thank you so much for joining us today. Much appreciated.
You are welcome.